Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to the RightStream Radio Network, rejoicing in the flow of creativity. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at RightStream and hashtag RightStream. Thanks for listening to the RightStream Radio Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to RightStream Tuesday. This is your host, Daria Ann, and I want to thank you for joining me. It is 1 p.m. on the East Coast here in South Florida, and I have to tell you, it's looking a little stormy. I know it's one of those South Florida days where it's, you know, sunny and then the clouds roll in and then you think it's going to rain and then the sun comes out again. So with any luck, we will get through this broadcast without any technical challenges. But as you know, Blog Talk Radio has technical challenges regardless of the weather. So just bear with me today and hopefully it'll be smooth sailing. But I am the founder of the RightStream Radio Network, which you can find out more about at our website, rightstreamradio.com. And you can check out our archives by going to blogtalkradio.com/rightstream and listen to all of the shows on the network. We broadcast 5 out of 7 days right now, which I'm really excited about. And we are working on plans to add a couple of new shows here in the coming months. So please bear with us as we make these changes and check out our lineup of hosts at rightstreamradio.com. So I am so excited to welcome another wonderful author and patriot from the CLFA group on Facebook, and that, of course, is the Conservative Libertarian Fiction Alliance, which I've been proud to be a member of now for a few months since I think it was Kia Hebe and Robert Bertrand who first told me about it. And I have to tell you, I mean, it's been such a pleasure not only to get to know everyone in this group as friends, but also it's provided me a wealth of wonderful guests for this program. And it's been really easy to plan my episodes and to bring people on. And it's always nice, of course, when your guests share the same love of liberty and the United States as you do. It makes things a lot easier. And it's just been amazing to discover just how much creative talent is really out there. And of course, with the benefits of new media, you know, and the ability now to self-publish and use social media to connect with each other, with fellow writers and with readers, that's been a big boost to helping talented people really get their work out there, unlike in the old days. So I'm real excited this week to welcome author Christopher Bunn to the program. And I'm just going to go read a little bit about him from his blog, ChristopherBunn.com, and that's B-U-N-N.com, and you can check out all of his books there. He has written several, and the cover designs are absolutely beautiful, and that's one of the things I'm going to talk to him about today, because they're just so mesmerizing, I think, is the word that comes to mind. I mean, from the moment I went on his site and checked everything out. So please visit ChristopherBunn.com for more information, but here's a little bit from his bio. He says, I live on a farm with my family in California. Whenever I have a bit of free time, I usually do some writing or make a beeline for the guitar or piano. Life has always been like that. I first started writing in earnest in sixth grade, laboring under the assumption that stories about intelligent avocados, blenders, and extraterrestrials would find a ready market. Reader reactions subsequently convinced me otherwise. Several decades later, I write mostly fantasy and science fiction, though the genre of humor greatly interests me, as P.G. Wodehouse and Richard Powell are two of my favorite authors. I certainly don't make my living from writing, though that's always a moon to shoot for. Speaking of making a living, I always enjoy reading Louis L'Amour's mini biography on the backs of his books. It's a nice punch in the face to contemplate what he did and how that might have shaped his writing. Mule Skinner, Boxer, Sailor, the list goes on. Myself, I've worked a fair amount of jobs so far. Welder, irrigator, house painter, gardener on an Israeli kibbutz, orphanage in Ethiopia, ran a post office in a UN refugee camp in Thailand, associate producer and jack of all trades for a TV production company in Scotland, construction down in the Amazon, data processor for a health insurance company, interactive producer for an animation company in Chicago, ran my own company for a while and produced kids' DVDs, and farming and land use consultant. Being a father and husband, however, is the hardest and best job of all. Wow, I mean, I'm blown away just reading that. So without further ado, I want to welcome author Christopher Bunn to WriteStream Tuesday.
Aria, thank you for having me.
Hey, Christopher, thank you for being here. Wow, that is quite a biography. And as you know, and as my listeners know, I'm pretty informal with these interviews. So I first want to start out just by giving you a chance to kind of introduce yourself here on the air, and then we'll get to talking about some of these things.
Well, your reading my biography kind of touched on most of the high points in my life. Just to flesh that out a little bit more, when I graduated from high school, I didn't want to go right away to college. I was kind of tired of school by that time, typical rebellious teenager. So I actually went away and did 4 years, a little bit more than 4 years of missions with a Christian mission, and did a lot of wandering around the world. Came back, got a degree, did some more wandering, and then I had wanderlust, really, is what did it. And that's why you have all those weird jobs in there, in the Amazon and Thailand and Scotland. That was a great job because a lot of the BBC stuff we were doing were very small crew, on-location type stuff, so you'd jet down to the Greek Isles for a couple weeks or down to Fiji or hopping around England. And that said, my professional background really is more in television and entertainment than anything else. I have a master's degree from Wheaton in TV and film production, and I worked a couple years, like I said, in Scotland for a company that was doing mostly productions for the BBC as well as ITV, some of the other UK channels. And then after that, like you mentioned in the biography, I worked for an animation company called Big Idea Productions that made VeggieTales and a couple other shows in Chicago. And I produced their DVDs and also produced a lot of their video games for them. And then after that, I started my own company and produced kids' DVDs, a lot of Barney shows, which was excruciating torture to do. Because when you're working on shows like that... What's that?
I said, so we should all blame you for Barney.
Oh, gosh.
Is that right?
Oh, it's a money-making machine, but when you're working on shows like that, you have to watch the shows over and over and over again in order to figure out how you're going to produce. When I say produce, I wasn't producing the actual shows themselves, but when a studio wrapped on a Barney show, I would get that, and my team then would turn it into an actual DVD. So we would add all the special features and the menus, and if there's something like a game on the ROM portion of it, stuff like that, and then we'd turn that into a master and push that back to the Barney crowd. But my kids do not watch Barney.
Well, you know, as you were talking, it sounds like almost like it's good torture for, like, Gitmo detainees or, you know, anybody that the CIA is trying to question. Just, you know,
oh,
force them to sit and listen to Barney.
Cruel and unusual punishment.
That is too funny. But, you know, it's so impressive. And, gosh, you know, listening to you, I'm almost a little jealous that you had the opportunity to get so much life experience, you know, not just by working all around the world. It's really invaluable because you had... You know, you came back and got your education, but you really got the best of both worlds with real-world practical experience, it sounds like.
Yeah, very much so. And you know, reflecting back on that time, and I'm 45 now, so that all started quite a while ago, but I think the American drive to send kids to college right after high school is largely misguided. I mean, I can't make a complete blanket statement. I think it's okay for some kids to go right away, but for a lot, I think it's a really bad move. You know, I think it's a waste of money. It's a waste of their time. You know, that time could be better spent, you know, maybe apprenticing in a trade or just going off and doing charity work somewhere or, you know, spending some time in a third world country. There's nothing like that that'll put your head on straight and give you more proper priorities.
Sure.
And then for me, you know, when I was doing all that, and I spent a lot of time in the third world, but when I came back to go to college, I knew exactly what I wanted. And I didn't waste any time, you know, jumping around through different majors. I'd been forced to grow up. And it's just a pity that sort of path isn't encouraged more in the United States.
Oh, my gosh. I so agree with you. I mean, looking back, I wish that, you know, I hadn't gone straight to college. I think it would have been good for me, you know, as I look back on my own life. Of course, I don't have any regrets now, but your point is totally valid. And the other thing, Christopher, that I think is wrong in our culture is this idea that everybody has to go to college. Because, you know, you mentioned learning trades, and I think it's so important. I mean, that's even lost even in, high school education these days. Kids aren't being taught practical skills like, you know, how to open up a bank account, you know, how
right.
to manage money. And so I just think that there's too much emphasis on everybody having to go to college. And, of course, I think a lot of that, and I want to get your opinion on this, is driven by the student loan racket, because these schools know, hey, if you can't afford our tuition, the government, you know, i.e. taxpayers, will just give you a loan. And so we'll just keep artificially inflating tuition and encouraging all kids that college is a right.
Yeah,
right.
No, you're right. I agree with you. I think a lot of it is the loan racket. And just the huge amounts of money that are involved there, you know, for the government and for the academic institutions. But I think in combination with that, it's also this crazy expectation in our society that you're owed a fantastic job and a fantastic living, and when you graduate with your bachelor's degree or your master's degree, you're going to be, you know, hitting the ground running with a six-figure salary, which I think is an absolute ludicrous expectation.
Yeah.
And that said, I think what's amazing about, like, just the simple trade schools or apprenticeships, you know, if you go out and learn how to be a good plumber or electrician or a carpenter or something like that, or an HVAC guy, yeah, it's a humble job, you know, from society's point of view, but you're probably going to be making a heck of a lot more money than the guy walking out of college with a four-year degree or a master's degree with a huge amount of debt, and he's probably not going to get hired in the profession that he studied.
Yep.
You know, he's probably going to go home and work at Starbucks.
You know, that is so true. I mean, I think of, you know, my own dad, you know, came from immigrants and he became a doctor, and my grandfather on my mom's side became a pharmacist. But within our family, we also had people who were very successful plumbers and barbers and you know, just other trades, and they did very well for themselves. So I think, you know, I don't know, some of it's like this elitist kind of attitude that certain jobs are too good, you know, or beneath you, or I'm not quite sure exactly. I think maybe it's a combination of a lot of different things. But
yeah.
You're absolutely right.
Yeah, yeah, it's kind of a shame. It's in a nutshell, I look at it as being, as the summation of that whole problem is something like a TV show like The Voice. You know, and these kids get on there, I think they're delusional, because they're all getting on saying, oh, this is my one shot at life, and this is my dream, and I'm going to become a superstar. It's like, no, you aren't. You know, like maybe one in a million might.
Yeah.
But be content with, you know, whatever life has brought you, you know, something humble, and learn to be content with that, and you're going to have a much happier life. But anyways, we're kind of wandering into strange fields here, but almost fascinating.
Just one other quick thing I want to say on this point, and then we will definitely move on, because I want to talk about you and your books and all the things that you do. But I also think another problem in our culture is that it seems to be that most people want to be famous versus being productive citizens.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. They want to be the next Honey Boo Boo, regardless of what that's going to do to their soul.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Christopher, how does your outlook, let's say, come out in your writing? Now, you've written, what, about 11 books from what I saw on your website?
Yes, something like that. I've lost track.
Well, my gosh, congratulations. I mean, I'm about to finish my third, and I'm thinking, wow, that's really great. And then I look at somebody like you, and I'm like, man, he's, like, way ahead of me. But, you know, now your books are mostly in the fantasy genre, is that correct, in science fiction?
Yeah, the bigger ones are mostly fantasy, and then I've written some science fiction and then quite a lot of humor. And I know a lot of people say that's a bad thing. They say, oh, you should stick to one genre and really make your mark there so your readers know exactly what they're going to get, you know, the next time you publish a book. And there's a lot of truth in that, but I just enjoy writing that other stuff, so I have to write it. I mean, you probably know how it is being a writer yourself.
Yep. No, I'm totally with you. Exactly, and I don't want to make this about me, but let me just say that this last book I'm ghostwriting for somebody else is a complete departure from anything else I've ever written, and I'm actually enjoying it very much. So I'm with you. I don't think, you know, in the age of new media, which I mentioned when I started the show, I think I don't think those old rules apply necessarily anymore. What do you think about that?
No, they well, I'm kind of torn because I know a lot of writers, you know, especially self-published ones, who rigorously stick to a genre, and I can see how that works well for them, you know, because they really maintain audience loyalty and brand loyalty, and their readers know exactly what they're going to get. Whereas, you know, if you're writing multiple genres, it's kind of like you're trying to connect with disparate audiences all the time. So it's sort of, you lose a little steam, I think, in the process, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, you know, if you have the time and the energy, why not do that stuff? And and speaking of kind of disparate creative streams, one thing that's really nice about not necessarily new media, but just the way technology has improved and become cheaper and more accessible, I think it's very, very viable now for authors to get into different kinds of medium with their creativity. And case in point, I just wrote a script for an indie film which was released last year, and it didn't get theater distribution, but it was a low budget film. It was about $150,000 budget, but we got picked up for foreign distribution. We're on TV in France, Russia, the UK, a big cable provider down in South America, one in the Middle East, and then here in the States, we're on iTunes and Netflix and sales in Walmart and some video on demand places on the web. And it's gonna make money. You know, it's not gonna make a ton of money, and it's not gonna make headlines, but it's another way to get your creativity out there. And with the fact that filmmaking itself nowadays is so cheap, in terms of anybody's got a Mac can edit, and you can go out and buy a pretty good camera for a couple $1,000s, and there's gonna be some film geeks and freaks in your area, you know, and theater people, and you can cobble together a production if you have the will to do it. So that said, there are lots of new avenues, I think, for creatives these days.
Yeah, it's really exciting. And Christopher, what's the name of that, in case anyone listening wants to check it out? Where can they find it?
It's called The Fellows Hip, The Rise of the Gamers, and the genre is a buddy road comedy, and what it is, it's about a group of high school geeks who are online gamers, and they're trying to make it to the regional online competition for a Lord of the Rings game.
Oh, cool.
And it's, you know, it's $150,000, so it's not Citizen Kane.
Yeah.
But it was done correctly, and we got permission from the Tolkien estate to reference Tolkien and Lord of the Rings, because a lot of the script, the story itself, mirrors things that happens in the Lord of the Rings. And the Saul Zanz Company, which controls the Tolkien estate for film purposes, likes to sue people if you don't approach them and get permission. But they read our script, and they said, that's fine, we'll sign off on it. So it's a nice little film. But is doable, you know, and in the past, like 20 years ago, you couldn't do something like that. It's impossible.
No. It's really a great time to be a creative person, I think.
Yeah, it is, definitely.
For those reasons. You know, it's funny, you brought up, and that's another great point that you brought up, I think, that self-published authors and any creative person needs to be very aware of, and that is, you know, the whole legal component to everything, too. You know, I think, you know, getting back to the author realm, I mean, you know, if you're a traditionally published author, then you have, you know, a publishing company behind you that's looking into all of that stuff. But I find sometimes self-published authors really need to be careful about things like you just described, like with the Tolkien estate, you know, just to make sure that you are, you know, crossing all your T's and dotting all your I's. I think that's one of the drawbacks if you're not a seasoned author, or if you're, you know, you're just immediately going the self-publishing route, that you need to be aware of and get good legal advice for things like that.
Yeah, definitely. You need to be prudent. I mean, a lot of it is common sense. You know, things like quoting song lyrics, you know, you're going to get sued. Like if you quote the Rolling Stones and they catch wind of that, they will shut you down. I mean, that kind of thing happens. But I think most writers are have enough common sense to avoid minds like that, but there are quite a few that don't, it seems like.
Yeah. And, you know, I love, and I'll call it independently published and self-published. I think the stigma is starting to go away because there are so many wonderfully talented independently published authors out there. But I also think that there's still enough of a stigma, and just in general anyway, that the practice should be, you know, making sure that it's high quality, that it's edited properly, that you have a good story, because I do believe that people, there's more of a critical eye if somebody knows a book is self-published than there may be if it's traditionally published. Do you agree with that?
I do, and that's kind of a painful topic because I hang out on a lot of some big writers' forums with a lot of self-published, independent published authors, and there's a lot of people who think like us who are aware of that you need to put some money into hiring a proper editor and a cover designer and things like that. But then there's a lot of people who just write stuff and just throw it out there, and it's dreadful. I mean, just dreck and that sort of deluge of trash, you know, tars everybody else. And you can't, I mean, you know, you can't come along and say, hey, you shouldn't be publishing, you know, because you don't have the right to say that. But it'd be nice if there was some kind of, I don't know, some kind of gatekeeper existing within the self-published world that would filter out that stuff or at least encourage those people to, you know, hey, take a couple of years and hone your craft and earn some money and hire an editor and don't just throw out your stuff onto Amazon.
Yeah, you know what I also find, Christopher, is that like through your connections we make online, like with the CLFA, there are a lot of really seasoned authors and editors willing to look at your things for free or for very little cost, if any. And so,
yeah, that's
you know,
true.
There's so many resources out there that there's no reason to just rush and throw something out there that's not the very best it can be.
Yeah, you're exactly right. Yeah, there's a lot of very nice people willing to help.
So which is great. Which brings up, go ahead.
But to do it right, I mean, it does take some money. I mean,
like
with my fantasy trilogy, the Torme trilogy, for editing, I probably spent, I'm just trying to add it in my head, well, you know, at least in excess of $3,000 in editing. And that was just a copy editor, so a very, very sharp-eyed lady who's just editing my grammar, as well as internal story consistency, so you know, making sure that this person that you mentioned this chapter then shows up 200 pages later is the same person, you know, and you're not
right.
Changing something vital in some detail about them, all that stuff all the way down to grammar and spelling and style, voice style and things like that. So not a story editor per se. But I had to spend that money. You know, I think I'm a pretty good writer, but I can't see myself critically enough. You know, I need somebody else doing that. And
yeah.
It's expensive to do it right.
Yeah, no, I agree. And the other thing is too, like, when you're the writer and you know what you mean, what you intend to say, if you're reading a paragraph, you're going to see it the way you intend to see it. Whether or not it actually reads that way. You know what I'm saying? Like, sometimes I literally do not see a typo because I know what I want it, how I want it to read, but that's not what's there. So you need, like, another set of eyes, totally fresh eyes, you know, for even for little things like that.
Yeah, you're right. And not just typos, but, like, just plot and story and character because you bring all the preconceptions and knowledge inside your mind to reading the story, whereas somebody who's going to read it who doesn't know you, they don't have all that.
Right.
You know, so they're not going to be filling in the blanks like your mind does. That's why that right there is why every writer, I think, needs to have a collection of really brutal beta readers, you know, who will just tell you, this sucks, and you need, I hate this, and this is boring, and why'd you do that? And, you know, more negative than positive, I think, is so much more beneficial.
Yes, and you also need a thick skin.
Yeah,
as a writer.
Yeah. Very thick. Yeah, for beta readers, and then when you start getting reviews, yep. When I first started out, in my first couple one-star reviews, I've gotten a fair amount of one-stars and two-stars on Amazon and Goodreads, places like that. Man, it hurts. But then after a while, I was like, whatever. Who cares?
Yeah. No, it's true. Now, Christopher, do you design your book covers, or who did you hire someone to design them?
The really fancy ones, the fantasy ones, I hired a artist in Moscow, a Russian guy. And I was first hunting around in the States trying to find an American artist, and I know lots of people who work in that industry because I worked in animation for so long. But to get somebody to do a single illustration at that caliber here in the States, you know, it's like $2,500, somewhere around there. It's just too much. So I found this guy in Russia, and I think he charged me about $800 an illustration, which I thought was an amazing deal just because of his caliber.
Yeah, they're beautiful, beautiful book covers. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, he's an amazing artist. Really, really nice guy, too.
Yeah, and that's good. Well, I'm lucky that Kia Heavey, I'm glad I discovered her as part of the CLFA, and, you know, she did a great job for my client's book that hopefully we'll be releasing here in the next couple of weeks. But it's so true that people really do judge a book by its cover. And so, I mean, to skimp on that, I think, is just crazy. I don't know why anybody would.
Yeah, and there are, you know, if $800 a cover for my, you know, so $2,400 for my trilogy, that's quite a lot of money. But I have a good job, so I can kind of subsidize my writing. But for other people, there's quite a lot of designers, you know, people like Kia, and there's other people out there, and you can find a pretty good cover designer for about, you know, $200, $300.
Yeah.
And it's going to look pretty darn good.
Yeah, absolutely. So you really, I think that's the part that a lot of, if you're a first, especially if you're a first-time self-published writer, you don't think about, you know, some of the expenses that are going to be involved. It's not just like you write a book and, oh, there it is, you know, and it's really important, I think. I wrote a blog post about this a while back about the importance of, you know, having a budget in mind for all of these things and then including the marketing budget, which is something I wanted to move into, a discussion I wanted to move into with you. You know, what kinds of things do you do to promote your books?
Oh, gosh, I was afraid you were going to ask that.
Yeah.
It's the one area where I just don't understand what's going on. And it could be a personality thing because I'm sort of a reticent person. I'd much rather, I'm the sort of much rather listen to people talk than talk myself. So I don't like putting myself out there. So that translates into pretty poor marketing for my books. When I first started out, I first started publishing back in the end of 2010. And then I sent out requests to all different sorts of book blogs and reviewers and online magazines and places like that, and very little return, though I did get a few places, like Fantasy Book Critic, which is a pretty influential blog. They agreed to review one of my books, and that was a big help, actually. And that was interesting because I did end up getting quite a lot of book bloggers and review sites to review or blog about me, but most of that stuff didn't seem to have any effect at all. But then a couple key places like Fantasy Book Critic, which has huge traffic, and it's all, you know, it's genre-specific. You know, it's people come there because they're fantasy fans.
Mm-hmm.
That had a very big effect. You know, that was beneficial. The other thing that's beneficial, of course, is I've had a few BookBub ads, and those always are tremendous shots in the arm. But then, you know, giving away books on Goodreads or library things, I've never seen anything beneficial out of those. It's nice to have people read my books, and I don't know if they're reading them. They might just be storing them on their Kindle, but I see that as a waste of time. I mean, at least for myself. People have different experiences, you know. That's kind of the random thing about marketing for books, because you go on to some of these writers' forum, like the Writers Cafe on KindleBoards.com, and people talk about their marketing experiences, and one person will say, yeah, I did this and this and this and this, and it was great. And I'll go out, you know, I'll go and check out their book and read a sample and go, okay, you know, it's a decent book. It's well-written, decent cover. They had a good return on their marketing. And then somebody else will say they tried the same exact things, and I check out their book, and it's decent writing, you know, good cover, all that, but nothing, you know, crickets. So that said, the whole marketing thing of books, to me, is a real puzzle because nothing seems all that reliable.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've had that experience yourself.
Yeah, it's interesting. It kind of depends. It's funny because there's so many different platforms out there that you can go crazy if you don't pick like a few that you're going to use, like, you know, whether it's Twitter or Facebook, Goodreads. So I've found in my experience that I kind of try to narrow things down, and then getting involved in different groups like the CLFA, you know, not just for our shared outlook on freedom and liberty, but also for the professional interaction and advice. That's been the most helpful to me. But I've also found, Christopher, that we really shouldn't overlook the old-fashioned, I'll call it old-fashioned marketing, of sort of putting yourself out there as a quote-unquote local author in whatever geographical area you're living in, and getting out and speaking to book groups and libraries. And, I mean, there's so many organizations that are always looking for speakers. I've found that I've had as much success with that as I've had with anything online.
Well, that's good to hear, because actually, you know, it's funny you bring that up, because on this Friday, I'm going to be speaking at I think they call it like a literary guild down near Los Angeles. And it's the first time I've ever done something like that, where it's actually face-to-face and somewhat local. So I'll be interested to see what the result of that is. And actually, you know, hearkening back to our discussion of how people view self-published writers versus traditional, we touched on that briefly before. The other interesting thing about Friday is there's going to be 5 authors speaking, and myself and 4 others, and I'm the only self-published person on that list. The others are all traditional. So I'm going to be really curious to see if there's any difference because of that as well.
Yeah. Hey, I may have to bring you back on the show to fill us in on how it all goes.
Anytime.
Well, that's fantastic, though. I mean, you can give a whole different perspective on the whole publishing process.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. And to be honest, you know, I think in relation to average independently published authors, I've been relatively successful. I've sold quite a lot of books, actually. And I always joke with my wife that it probably happened because of God, because we had this 1 year back in 2011 when our toddler, our newborn, had to have open heart surgery. So there's some huge medical costs, and then my wife's car died at the same time, and we've got 3 kids, so we're like, okay, we've got to bite the bullet and get a minivan and become the typical American. So we had these two really big costs, and I sold a ton of books that year. I mean, a ton. And made enough money to cover all the medical bills and buy my wife a Honda Odyssey.
Fantastic.
And it was, I think I'm somewhere north of about 75,000 books.
God, that's phenomenal.
Which is pretty decent, I think.
Yeah, that's probably, I'll tell you, I think you're probably the highest of all the self-published authors I've interviewed. So that's fantastic. Congratulations.
Thanks. Oh, you got to land, you got to go after somebody like Hugh Howey, get him on your show. And that guy is, have you read the Wool books?
No, I haven't.
He's kind of, he's sort of the indie legend, it seems like, nowadays. But I remember when he was on a writer's forum way back when, and he wasn't selling anything. But then he just took off, and he's been New York Times bestseller, and books got optioned by Ridley Scott for film, and just huge numbers. Absolutely amazing. He's a good writer, too. Those are great stories.
So he was an independent author, you're saying?
Yeah, and he still is. He's a pretty nice guy, actually. He's a hybrid, actually. He kept his ebook rights and then did a deal with, I don't know who it was, Simon & Schuster, Scribner, one of those guys, just for print.
Ah, the best of both worlds. I like that.
Yeah. But I think he had the leverage to pull it off, you know, because he was doing such big numbers. He basically said, I don't need you guys, so sign my contract.
Yeah, you know, the interesting thing is, too, that I found with most guests that come on the show is that even if they are traditionally published, the way it is now, you still have to do so much of your own marketing, you know, even if you are with a big publishing company.
Yeah, you do. And that's something I never really realized until I got into this. I just thought, oh, if you get a deal with a traditional house, they're going to do all this marketing and send you on a book tour and do print ads and blah, blah, blah. But they don't. They do it for the big guys.
Yeah.
You know, but not for the mid-listers.
You know, yeah, exactly. So, Christopher, who are your biggest, in terms of writing, who are your biggest influences? You know, who are your favorite authors and some of your favorite books? And what's had the biggest impact on your writing career?
There's a couple obvious ones, but that's a hard question to answer. I was actually thinking about that this morning in a different context, and I realized that a lot of the books that I read as a kid, and we didn't have TV, so me and my brothers read a ton at a young age. But I realized that a lot of the books I read as a kid, they still stick with me now as an adult. And, you know, I'll read books nowadays that I very much enjoy, but they really don't stick with me. But these things that I read decades ago, you know, like Murray Sendak and Tomi Unger, have stayed in my mind like monoliths. And I think a lot of that stuff has shaped me as a writer, like the Andrew Lang fairy tale compilations. And, of course, I grew up on C.S. Lewis and Tolkien, Lloyd Alexander, you know, the Prydain Chronicles, Susan Cooper with her Dark is Rising series, Rosemary Sutcliffe's historical fiction. She wrote a lot about the Roman era in Britain. And then, you know, when I got a little bit older, I became very impressed with Charles Dickens. I've always been really fond of him, just how he, for lots of reasons, but one of them is just how he creates his characters. I mean, the guy he's untouchable, I think, and how he creates these absolutely memorable characters, good and bad. I mean, the Pickwick brothers, David Copperfield, Uriah Heep, all these people. But then Dickens is really interesting, too, in terms of how he balances subplots. Because you read, usually most Dickens books, you read them, and there's all these multiple subplots going on, and they weave in and out, in and out, in and out, and you think, how are these going to come together? But he does it, and he always does it really well, too. He's amazing that way.
Yeah, I love Sidney Carton. He's probably one of my favorite characters. So.
Yeah, he's an amazing character. He's incredible.
Just love him. You know, it's funny. I think my appreciation for Dickens, I think I developed it as I got older. I remember in high school hating having to read him because his books were so long.
Yeah.
Even though I
love
to read. But I think for me at least, he became an acquired taste. But you're absolutely right. I mean, he's just the characters that he created. And I just, The Tale of Two Cities, I think, is one of those books that really stayed with me.
That's a fantastic book. I mean,
yeah.
And that. If we could wander into that topic a little bit, you know,
sure.
A book like Tale of Two Cities is so amazing, I think, because, I mean, one, it's an incredible story, and it's really well written, but the themes in it, you know, sacrifice and redemption, you know, the redemption of Sidney Carton willing to sacrifice himself for somebody else, you know, even though it means his death, and he never gets the girl and all this kind of stuff, but what an incredible story, and the way it teaches without being teachy, you know, it's not a preachy book, but Dickens definitely is saying something in that story. And I think, you know, from a conservative's point of view, in a conservative and a Christian, that's the kind of writing that we need to be doing. These amazing stories that aren't preachy. You know, you're not writing the story because you want to communicate a message. You're writing the story because you want to write a good story, but because of who you are and what you believe in, and because it's true to who you are. You know, if you genuinely are a conservative, you're going to be writing from that perspective, and it's not going to be a forced thing. Those are the best stories. And I think, actually, C.S. Lewis, in one of his essays, said that the best way to communicate truth to people as a writer, and he was talking about writing in that essay, is if you believe it yourself, if it's a part of who you are, then he said, don't worry about it then. It's going to come out naturally in your stories, and that's the best way to do it. And he said, whereas if you try to force it, the story is going to end up feeling artificial, and people will pick up on that, and they will not enjoy it. And I think he's completely right. He's right about that.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And we talk a lot about that in the CLFA group. It's just, you're so right. It's just who you are will come out in the pages. You don't, you write your story. And I think especially today in the culture we're living in, you know, I'm one of these people that believe that, you know, as Breitbart and some of these other sites do, that really culture drives politics. And so what we're really dealing with now is a cultural problem more than anything else. And so books like, you know, we mentioned Tale of Two Cities, but books like that where it celebrates heroic individuals, ordinary people who manage to rise above and do heroic things. I mean, we need so much more of that. And those themes of sacrifice for someone else and putting somebody else maybe before yourself because that's truly unconditional love. Those kinds of themes we just really need because we're living in this culture of self-absorption and instant gratification. And you mentioned it earlier with people having this entitlement of, well, I graduated college, so now I should have a six-figure job. So I just believe, you know, combined with the ability to independently publish, I'm just so happy to see so many people, you know, to know so many people like you who are out there creating good books like that.
Yeah, it's a vital thing. You know, I think Breitbart, didn't he say politics is downstream from culture or whatever? Some phrase like that.
Culture is upstream from politics or culture drives politics, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's true, and I think if we have more writers and creatives and, you know, regardless of what the medium is, but just operating from a real healthy world view, you know, where the individual is responsible for his choices, you know, and you've got the option to make good choices or bad choices. And if you make bad ones, there's going to be consequences. And if you make good ones, you know, you're not necessarily going to have a wonderful life, but generally, you know, your life is going to pan out and your family is going to love you and your kids are going to love you. And, you know, that's a really complicated, big, thorny subject, and it kind of devolves down, from the way I see it, down to, discussion of Judeo-Christianity and how that's influenced, you know, modern philosophy and government and culture and all that kind of stuff and the culture wars. But if we have more people writing from that perspective, and like I said, not necessarily trying to force a message, but just writing from that perspective, you know, where your hero actually is a hero, you know, and is not a, because you read a lot of thrillers, especially these days, or fantasy books. You know, George Martin, guy's notorious for creating heroes. They're just as despicable as the villains, you know. So he's operating from a worldview essentially of nihilism. And, you see that a lot, I think, in modern books.
Yeah, and I hate that myself, yeah.
Yeah, I despise it. And especially for how that affects kids, because they start thinking, well, you know, this is the normal way, and this is how you treat women, and this is what family means, and it's a load of junk, and, you know, I need to be just operating for myself. You know, and they're getting that from their culture, from their pop culture. And we need to counter that.
Absolutely. You know, and because one of the things that I despise about the left, but they do so well, of course, for their own agenda, is, you know, they exploit human weakness, so feelings of envy and jealousy, and, you know, they exploit human frailty to expand their own power. So instead of pointing to someone who's very successful, let's say somebody that worked their way up from nothing and became a millionaire by creating good products and services and jobs for people and worked his butt off to get there, instead of pointing to that person as a role model, they point to him and say, he's taking money from you. He needs to be taxed more. You know, I find that despicable, absolutely despicable.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, those should be the role models, but you're exactly right. They're pointing to those people, like the Koch brothers is kind of the stereotype nowadays, but they point to them and say, you should be envious and greedy of these people. We should take from these guys, and these people have held down their workers, you know, and just they're twisting everything upside down. It's pretty sad. I mean, I'm optimistic in some ways, because, you know, there are a lot of things going on, you know, Breitbart and all the creatives and how, you know, the self-publishing revolution has unleashed a lot of voices that couldn't make it in the past. But at the same time, I mean, there's so much inertia in the system and in the culture. It's, you know, like pushing that boulder, that Greek myth of the guy pushing the boulder up the hill.
Yeah, no, it's so true. You know, and it's funny, even on people who represent our side on AM talk radio and other places, sometimes don't get it. You know, I had the honor of being on Hugh Hewitt's program. You probably know him. He's out in California.
Oh, yeah. He's an amazing guy. Yeah.
Great guy. Yeah. And this is not a – I'm not slamming him by any means. And the guy gave me like 8 minutes of airtime, which was phenomenal. And this was December, Christmas week, and this past year. And so, you know, I talked about the CLFA and fiction writers, and he just seemed amazed that – conservatives can make an impact through fiction. And I did say this on the air, and I certainly mean no disrespect to people like Mark Levin, who I adore, and others who write nonfiction books. But the fact of the matter is most Americans are not going to read Liberty and Tyranny. We might, because we're politically inclined, we care about the culture and the country. But, you know, it amazes me how they overlook the importance of good fiction that conveys, you know, that has these attitudes embedded within it and entertains people without, you know, like you said before, preaching to them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, the stuff by Mark Levin and all those guys, God love them, it's essentially preaching to the choir.
Yeah.
And that really doesn't solve a whole lot. And you're right, fiction is the way to sneak past people's barriers and preconceptions, because if you write a good story, anybody's going to like it and read it, you know. And it's strange. It seems like in the conservative movement, whether it's conservative Christianity or just mere conservatism itself, it seems like we're more given to writing works of analysis and critique, nonfiction, like you're talking about, rather than creativity itself. And I've seen that manifest in different ways, and I'm sure you've seen it too, but one interesting thing is I did my master's degree at Wheaton College outside of Chicago,
mm-hmm.
and Wheaton is kind of it's a literature geek's dream, because they have an archive there that's the biggest repository of original papers and manuscripts of Lewis and Tolkien. It's bigger than Oxford and Cambridge, actually, and they have Tolkien's writing desk is there, and furniture from their houses and all kinds of amazing stuff. And they also have tons of original material from G.K. Chesterton, Dorothy Sayers,
wow.
a lot of the Inklings, like Charles Williams, Owen Barfield. So just an incredible, incredible place. Absolutely amazing. And at the same time, there's a lot of professors at that college who are quite famous for writing books of critique and analysis on all those dead authors. Some big, big names. And one of them, I won't say his name, but one of the professors I became slight friends with, and I asked him one day, I said, you know, this institution glories in this archive and the kind of scholarly works you guys put out and critique, but you place no emphasis at all on students becoming the next Tolkien or Lewis. Because there's no push at that college. Even though that's like the that's the place where Lewis and Tolkien scholars go to read original material. And he got very angry with me. But the thing is, it's true. And that's kind of symbolic of, I think, conservatism as a whole. For some reason, we're good with critiquing, but not good with creating. And I don't understand why there's that dichotomy.
Yeah, it's very frustrating. Well, you know, in conservatives over the last several decades have ceded, you know, pop culture to the left. And I think the arts, you know, writing, filmmaking,
yeah.
whatever it is, that's all part of that, unfortunately. You know, and so I think a lot of conservatives just throw their hands up in the air and say, well, I'm not going to go support that movie because I don't like this person. But, you know, and this brings me to another point, though, Christopher. Like, I find it frustrating. Like, where are the deep-pocketed conservatives who can afford maybe to build a movie studio and start making good, virtuous films? Like, where are these people? Are they just so focused on nonfiction books, you know, that they don't care, they don't see the bigger picture? Because I do find that kind of, I want to pull my hair out. I mean, I don't have the money to do it, but God, surely there has to be people with money who believe in the Constitution who could do that.
Yeah, you're right. That's something I've wondered about, too, because there's a ton of incredibly successful, you know, conservative businessmen and businesswomen who've got millions, billions of dollars available, and they put them into PACs and 501c3s and c4s, and, you know, try to affect elections and do a lot of charitable work, which is wonderful, and I'm glad they're doing all that kind of stuff, but they don't seem to get in the creative side of the thing, other than the guy from Colorado who started the name is escaping right now, but he started the movie studio which did the Narnia books, and it did Holes by Louis Sachar. He owns the Denver baseball team there, and he's a billionaire.
I know who you mean, but I can't think of his name. Okay.
He did it. He put his money where his mouth is in terms of creativity. But, you know, it's just one guy.
Yeah.
And it needs to be more widespread. The need and the value of creativity within culture needs to be acknowledged more widely by conservatives, rich and poor.
Yeah. And the thing is, the irony is that these films do well when they come out.
Yeah.
You know, when a conservative film comes out that celebrates, you know, the United States or Christianity or good values, they usually do very well. It's like there's a hunger in the marketplace for them. And yet there's a dearth of studios producing them. It's just very strange.
It is strange. Yeah, that's something to think about a lot, you know, due to my background. But even if you had a studio putting out films that were more like the old Walt Disney films, like That Darn Cat, or, you know, Flubber, or films like
that.
Yeah,
I love Flubber.
They're films that they're not saying anything about the Constitution or George Washington or like that. They're just decent films with good people in them and reflecting good values and good families. You know, nothing flashy. But I bet you $1 million, if you put out films like that nowadays, they would do tremendously well. Because like you said, nobody's doing stuff like that. But I would love to be able to take my kids to something like that and not worry about them, you know, seeing and hearing some pretty reprehensible stuff.
Yeah, I'm
as
sure.
Well as being taught some pretty bad messages at the same time.
Exactly. You know, so something that comes close in modern life, I don't know if you'll agree with this, but I love the original Rocky is my favorite. But what I see in that, it's not that I don't even like boxing, but to me, that's not a movie about a boxer. It's a movie about a guy who wouldn't give up, who loved his country, who was very devout in his faith, and was a good, solid person in spite of his humble circumstances. You know, and that's one of the things I see. And I mean, I know a lot of people, well, I think it's there. I think people see it, but it's not like glaringly obvious. I mean, it's an entertaining story about a guy, you know, but you know, in all of those movies, especially the original one, I mean, he loves his country. He loves his faith. He's faithful to one woman. I mean, and so you can make movies like that, like you're saying, like you can celebrate those kinds of things without being obvious, without beating people over the head with it and still entertaining them. So I just don't understand why I don't get more of that in the cinema.
Yeah, no, you're right. And that's the kind of storytelling that I think is the most powerful because it creeps past people's defenses. Like C.S. Lewis, like that essay I mentioned, where you're not trying to bash him over the head, but you just write the story from what I would say is a proper, healthy worldview. And it's, you know, if the story's good, the people reading that are going to unconsciously pick up on those messages and those morals. Maybe part of the problem is that sort of process is really slow, you know, because to affect a culture with fiction that way, you need a million little tiny foot soldiers of stories going out to doing it.
Yeah.
Whereas if you can do it through a big Rush Limbaugh crusade or a big Mark Levin book or, you know, putting a guy into office and winning the Oval Office, you know, that's big and flashy and immediate and we can see results right away. And you might, but I think changing culture itself, even though that's harder and takes a longer time, is going to have much more lasting benefit.
Yeah. I agree. You know, and we just have a couple more minutes, but one thing I just want to comment on is that I think Sarah Palin is one person who really gets that. You know, I know a lot of conservatives criticize her. Oh, why did she do that Alaska series? Why is she doing? She's going to be doing that series for the Sportsman Channel. I think it comes out next month. You know, you see she writes books and she's, and I know a lot of people, I love her myself, but I know a lot of people on our side accuse her of being a celebrity, but I say to them, she gets it. She's engaging pop culture. She's, you know, she gets that it's not just about talking about policy and politics and that you've got to reach out to these other people who do unfortunately vote who don't have a lot of information. So
You're right. I admire Sarah Palin a lot. She does get it, you know, because she's reaching out and engaging people's hearts, you know, and where they live. And that is sadly overlooked by the conservative movement.
And the fact that she was savagely targeted by the left, and this is what they do to conservatives. So I just, you know, and look, I'm not the kind of person that demands like blind allegiance to every conservative leader, but I do think a little bit of respect is in order for the fact that this woman is not only still standing, but she's still fighting in spite of the relentless attacks against her and her family. So, but you know, in terms of the culture, yeah, I get what she's doing, and I think it's admirable. I mean, she's somebody else who's, you know, putting her money where her mouth is. And you know what? If she earns money in the process, good for her. I mean, I'm a capitalist. But I see too many people on our side criticizing her for making money for doing these things. And I'm like, are you kidding me? You know, I don't get it. There's like a disconnection there or something.
Yeah, yeah. Gosh, I wish we had a dozen more Sarah Palins, and we'd be doing quite well, I think.
Absolutely. Well, Christopher, my gosh, it has been such a pleasure. I can't believe how quickly the time has flown by today. But please, I want to give you the opportunity to let people know where they can find you and anything else you want to share before we sign off today.
Well, if people want to get in touch with me, my website's the best place, Christopher Bunn. And Bunn is spelled like the coffee maker, but we're not related to them, to my sad regret. ChristopherBunn.com. And if you know, if any of your listeners have questions about self-publishing or that process, or if they want to chat about VeggieTales or working in overseas and television, whatever, I'm always happy to talk to people. I'm a good,
fabulous,
pretty good responder to email. So
that's excellent. Well, thank you very much, and I may be taking you up on that in the future. Who knows?
Anytime.
Yeah, and I'll definitely see you in the CLFA group on Facebook, and just want to give them a shout-out again because I really appreciate all that they do and all the members there. Everyone there is just they're just great people. It's just a pleasure to belong to a group where there's a lot of support and we can disagree on things and we're still friends at the end of the comment thread. And, you know, we've mastered the art of playing nice, I guess, in the sandbox, even if we disagree on certain things. So,
yeah, definitely. Good group.
Yeah. So, well, Christopher, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to join me, and I hope to bring you, you know, I hope you'll be able to come back on in the future.
Yeah, I'd love to. Thank you very much, Daria.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Okay, you too. Bye.
All right, bye-bye. All right, ladies and gentlemen, that was Christopher Bunn. Please check out his blog at ChristopherBunn.com. I really enjoyed that interview, and I hope you did as well. I'm not going to talk too long today. I'm going to probably sign off here in the next couple of minutes because, yes, I've been in the middle of serious editing for Steps to Salvation, which is the book I've ghostwritten for my client, Shlomo Atiya. I want to encourage you to check out his blog, shlomoatiya.wordpress.com, and that's shlomoatiya.wordpress.com. We are going to be finishing up the editing process this week, and hopefully, if we get some pictures back in time that we're waiting for, we'll be able to publish his book within the next 7 to 10 days. I'm really, really working hard to make sure that we stick to that schedule. But I'm very excited. I think this book is going to have a huge impact, and I'm really looking forward to working on the marketing once we get to that phase. I'm really excited about it. Another thing I'm very excited about and I wanted to announce is that Cherry Tigress, who is the author of Toilet Paper People, some of you may remember that I interviewed her last year, yeah, just about a year ago, about her book, which is a haunting memoir of growing up with a horribly abusive, mentally ill mother, just a horrible book about child abuse. Well, horrible in one sense, but also inspiring in the way that she was able to overcome all of that ugliness and pain to become very successful and to become a very self-assured adult. But Cherry released a new edition of her book, and she actually included a quote of mine from my review last year on the front cover, so I'm very excited. So please go to Amazon.com and look up Toilet Paper People and check out Cherry's book. I mean, I highly recommend it. It is very, very difficult to read just because of the horrific, diabolical abuse that this girl experienced in her own home by a woman who adopted her supposedly because she wanted a child. But I'll tell you, it's definitely worth the read. In my case, it gave me a renewed appreciation really for my own upbringing and really just so much admiration for Cherry and people like her who are able to overcome those awful circumstances and still become productive, well-adjusted human beings and who are able to forgive amazingly. So please check out Toilet Paper People. Go to Amazon.com and you'll find it there. I want to thank everyone for listening again this week to another RightStream Tuesday. Please check out our website, rightstreamradio.com, where you can find out more about our hosts, John D. Gresham, Lisa Tarvez, Dr. Billy Eisenberg, family law attorney Sheena Benjamin Wise, and Kristen Fetterman. And you can also find out about all of our shows, including Military Monday, Just Believe, RightStream Tuesday, Family Power Hour, and Love, Liberty, and Lip Gloss. We've got a great lineup. I really appreciate all of my hosts. They work so hard. We all do this as a labor of love because we like to share great information and talented people with our audience and just do our part, I guess, to make a positive impact on our little corner of the world. So I thank you for your support. You can also visit my blog at dariadigiovanni.com to keep up with me. I'm also on Twitter at Daria Ann, D-A-R-I-A-A-N-N-E. You can also follow at RightStream and, of course, hashtag RightStream. And until next week, keep rejoicing in the flow of creativity, and I'll see you back here next Tuesday at 1 p.m. when I am going to be interviewing Liberty Island founders, well, two of the Liberty Island magazine founders, Jamie K. Wilson and Griff, which I cannot wait to do. I'm so excited to bring them back. So until then, everybody, God bless, and we'll see you back here for RightStream Tuesday next week at 1 p.m. Eastern.